This has been a test of the emergency interdimensional broadcasting system. Had this been an actual emergency, it would have been given instructions as to how to proceed between dimensions. And this is the Hermetic Hour, and I am your host, Bill Runyon. And tonight, we are going to have a discussion on the magical work and writings of the British occult adept, Dion Fortune. She was an exponent of the Golden Dawn tradition and also the Stella Matutina, and the founder of the Society of Inner Light. She was a writer of outstanding occult fiction, Moon Magic, The Sea Priestess, and the Dr. Taverner stories. We put up the cover of the Dr. Taverner with the Hainsbach illustration on the website. And many other titles, and her nonfiction titles include Psychic Self-Defense, The Mystical Kabbalah, which many consider to be her masterpiece, and The Cosmic Doctrine. Now, our featured guest for this topic will be the noted occult leader and author, Dr. Paul Clark, steward of the Fraternity of Hidden Light, and a longtime student of Dion Fortune's teachings and writings. So, if you want to look behind the veil on Dion Fortune's magical universe, tune in and be enlightened. So, let's get our initial facts in order here on Dion Fortune. Now, according to Wikipedia, Violet Mary Firth Evans was born on the 6th of December, 1890, and passed away on the 8th of January, 1946. She, of course, is better known as Dion Fortune. She was a British occultist and an author. Her pseudonym was inspired by her family motto, Deo non fortuna, which is Latin for by God, not fate. Now, she was born in Wales and grew up in a household where Christian Science was rigorously practiced. And you want to keep that in mind as we go through her career. She reported visions of Atlantis at age 4. You may recall that Taylor Codwell, the famous lady author, wrote a book on Atlantis at age 12. And the developing psychic abilities, she developed psychic abilities during her 20th year, at which time she suffered a nervous breakdown. Well, there's a little apocryphal story about that, which we'll get into later. Now, after her recovery, she found herself drawn to the occult. She joined the Theosophical Society, and that's important to remember, and attended courses in psychology and psychoanalysis at the University of London. She became a lay psychotherapist at the Medico-Psychological Clinic in Brunswick Square. Her first magical mentor was the Irish occultist and Freemason, Theodore Moriarty. Now, this Theodore Moriarty was the real-life model for Dr. Taverner in the Dr. Taverner stories. And you'll recall, if you go to the website, take a look at this copy, the whole copy of Dr. Taverner that we have up there, and this fascinating Hainsbach cover. I think it's just really beautiful. Now, in 1919, Dion Fortune was initiated into the London Temple of the Alpha and Omega. Now, this was after the split, after the scandal, and the Alpha and Omega was actually Mather's. That was Mather's Golden Dawn Temple in London. Mather's himself was still in Paris. And then she transferred to the Stella Matutina. And if you recall, the Stella Matutina was Dr. Falcon's reconstituted version of the Golden Dawn. So Dion Fortune certainly was a Golden Dawn aficionado, and very much influenced by that tradition. Now, she began writing a number of novels and short stories that explored various aspects of magic and mysticism, including the demon lover, the winged bull, the goat-foot god, and, of course, the secrets of Dr. Tavener. And this latter book is a collection of short stories based on her experiences with Theodora Moriarty. Two of her novels, The Sea Priestess and Moon Magic, became very influential within the religion of Wicca, especially upon Doreen Valiente. And I might mention it also very influential on my Wiccan friend Sarah Cunningham from years back in the 1970s. And in fact, Sarah Cunningham's whole tradition of Wicca was pretty much Dion Fortune, a mixture of Dion Fortune and the Golden Dawn. Now, she also wrote Psychic Self-Defense, and a book we're going to discuss tonight, we're going to discuss a very, very unusual, and I think in some ways remarkable book called The Cosmic Doctrine. Now, her book, The Mystical Kabbalah, which many consider to be her masterpiece and probably in some ways the best, one of the best books ever written on the Hermetic Kabbalah. And when I say the Hermetic Kabbalah, now you should understand that the Hermetic Kabbalah deviates and moves in some ways beyond the original Hebrew Kabbalah. And it has Rosicrucian influences, and it incorporates tarot, and it deals with classical and ancient Egyptian god forms, where the Hebrew Kabbalah does not. So the Hermetic Kabbalah is sort of a different thing. However, one thing I want to point out about the Mystical Kabbalah, and I know Rigardi thought it was a wonderful book, and I think it's very good too. But there is a major flaw in the Mystical Kabbalah. There's very, very little in the book about the paths. The book concentrates on the spheres. And the reason why this is because Dion Fortune was oath-bound, she felt that she shouldn't be revealing the paths, because so much of that material that she had on the paths was Golden Dawn secret. And so she kept it to herself. So she primarily concentrated in the Mystical Kabbalah on the Sephiroth, on the spheres. And now, in a way, that's kind of a good thing, because quite frankly, the Golden Dawn, and later, I think, of course, Paul Clark may disagree with me on this, but I think that they tended to overemphasize the paths and underemphasize the spheres. So there have been plenty of books since written describing all the path work and what have you, and all the correspondences. So Dion Fortune's book, even though it lacks specific practical information on the paths, it kind of corrects this imbalance, because there was way too much emphasis placed upon, in my opinion, placed upon the paths and the tarot, and the spheres were sort of considered to be, well, they're there, but, you know, we're really concerned with the paths. Now, therefore, but you should, if you're gonna read the Mystical Kabbalah, you should probably have as a companion to it, Rigardi's Garden of Pomegranates would be a good idea to have as a companion to it, and study the two together. Dion Fortune's fiction was something that we really are going to kind of, you know, really emphasize tonight, because most people today, who are familiar with her are really more familiar with her fiction than they are with her nonfiction. And she, these books were really remarkable. I mean, they were just remarkable. She had a very direct writing style, deep. Certainly a feminine perspective, which was very, very good, because up to that time, well, with the exception of Marie Corelli and a few other, but most occult fiction, such as there was written by men. And so this, and yet Dionne Fortune didn't write just for women. You know, so many books that fall into that category seem to be written strictly from a feminine perspective. For some reason or other, Dionne Fortune was able to find almost it is very deep introspective from the female position, and that's one of the things good about her writing. She is, it may be cathartic, but at the same time, she stays with the story. She stays with the plot. She stays with the message. She just doesn't wander off and spend a lot of time, talking about things that, or writing about things that don't really relate to what she's to the story. So her fiction is very, very well. It's beautifully done. And very convincing, but because she lived and breathed occultism, and so she had a deep inner knowledge of these workings, and also too, and this should be mentioned, that she was a trained psychologist, and she took a rather, what we would say, a psychological approach, but at the same time, traditional, spiritual, with reverence for mythology, reverence for supernatural power, and all of this, and yet at the same time, you had the very strong feeling that she was integrating this with, I hesitate to say that she was a Jungian, but it sure seems that way. In other words, this comes across, and the psychological aspects of this. In fact, Dionne Fortune, one of the things we can say about this is that took a more sophisticated hermetic psychological approach. When I say hermetic psychological, I mean that the approach that really this is a mental process, that we're not looking for sensational miracles. This is a mental process. This is and that the highest aspect of hermetic philosophy goes along with this. And so Dionne Fortune, actually, she believed that she didn't believe in totally independent demons. If you were under attack by a demon, as far as she was concerned, a black magician had sent it to you. She did not. She didn't have much use for the idea that there were these independent entities that could cause you harm but at the same time, she did believe in the supernatural power of the angels and what have you. So she had a quality of deference to the supernatural, but also very, very much in tune with the psychological. And so this does not, you can't call her writing anachronistic. And she was very, very much in tune with modern psychology, but yet at the same time, she had a reverence for the traditional spirituality. And the Moon Magic and the Sea Priestess, which are the two novels that as we just covered, that influenced the modern Wicca movement. These two novels are just really beautiful. This is the pagan priestess coming into her own. Now, all of Dion Fortune's novels, and I at one time or another read them all, they all seem to deal with aspects of paganism in the context of Rosicrucianism. Now, so you might actually say that you might get the impression from reading these that Dion Fortune herself was a pagan, and you might be, in a sense, you might be right, because remember the Golden Dawn at that time, still is, they venerated the Egyptian gods. At the same time, they reverenced the Hebrew Kabbalah and the Rosicrucian tradition of the divine inspiration of Jesus Christ, and all of this came together in a very comfortable and satisfying synthesis. There was no problem whatsoever in this hermetic Rosicrucian milieu that the Golden Dawn had. There was this synthesis. There was no problem with, you're venerating pagan gods, that's terrible, we can't do that. None of that. There was none of that at all. All of this was brought together, and it was harmonious, and they had no problem with venerating Jesus and venerating the Kabbalah and venerating Jehovah and having the angels and having the pagan god forms. All of this worked together. And which it does, of course, today, and which we do in the OTA and all of that. This was the flowering of the Hermetic tradition. I want to point something out, though. As Dion Fortune moved into her later years, as so often happens when magicians get older and they start seeing the end of the road coming and all of that, and they start becoming more and more Christian, in the sense that they start turning away from any veneration or interaction with the pagan pantheons, classical pantheons, and they become more and more devoted to the Christian principle. Now, what ended up happening, of course, with Dion Fortune is that she found it later years, she founded this Society of the Inner Light, which is still going. And Society of the Inner Light, by the time she just a little bit before she died, she really did get pretty close to an Orthodox Christian position. And after she passed on, the Society of the Inner Light carried on her work, but they carried on her work, but they tried depaganizing her earlier work, and moved. They became more and more more Christian, and more restrictedly Christian in their point of view. At one point, okay, we got a call in, and that should be Dr. Clark. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am, Polk. How you doing?
Oh, good. I was just starting to get critical, as you probably heard, of what happened to the Society of the Inner Light after Dion Fortune passed on. They started cutting. They even started censoring her old pagan books. You want to pick it up from here, there, and carry on, and yeah.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me while I was listening to your narrative there was that Dion Fortune believed in a threefold path. I think that's significant. That's where you did mention that the Golden Dawn had this unusual synthesis, but she really, really developed this to a greater extent. And this threefold path was the Hermetic, the Celtic, and the Orphic rays. Now, the Orphic ray is the one that becomes Christian at a higher level, according to her philosophy. The Celtic ray was the one that Wicca is most harmonious with, and of course the Hermetic ray is your ray of ceremonial magic and the Kabbalah. And she believed that for any initiatory school to be valid, they had to offer all three initiations. They couldn't be a valid initiatory school if they just went to one or two of those. And as you know, everybody has a preference when they come in to the initiatory path. Everybody has a preference. And if left up to their own, they tend to overbalance on that preference. And so she was very insistent that that the candidates for her school would be forced, more or less, to sample the other two paths in a certain order to develop an internal balance between the threefold ray, the threefold path, rather.
That is fascinating, and that is so valid. I you know, because here she's taking this synthesis, because the Golden Dawn, you know, as you know, they had done this without differentiating the rays. I think it wasn't Alice Bailey that came up with this ray concept, but the Golden Dawn, They didn't so much differentiate this. They integrated it all, and it didn't seem to. So she broke it out. She broke it out apparently into these three sections, and that's a good idea, because it allows you to look at all three and then integrate them yourself.
But I noticed that in the Golden Dawn grade system, the grades themselves will tend to activate these various components of the initiate psyche, so there is this awakening. But I've always maintained that the Golden Dawn spent so little time, they kind of rushed their candidates through the initiatory process, that they didn't have a time to develop and ground those different aspects that she did in her school.
Yeah.
Also, I noticed that she went back to the Hermetic grade system of only three grades, but that does equate to the Golden Dawn in a certain way on the Tree of Life.
Yeah, right. It also equates with Wicca too, because they certainly did. I think though that they were pretty much influenced by Masonry when they got started with the three degrees of Wicca.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that the influence that Moriarty had on her, and he was a Irish Freemason.
Oh yeah. And he was a psychologist, as I understand it. And you know, we talk about the Dr. Tavener. By the way, did you see we put on the website, we put the old Llewellyn Dr. Tavener cover up there. It has the Hainsbach painting on the cover.
Yes, I that's one that I still have. I love that cover.
Yeah, my one of my cats chewed the corner, but I treasure that book, and I love that Hainsbach illustration. One of the things though that I found kind of disturbing about the Society for Inner Light, that, you know, I corresponded with Basil Wilby, Gareth Knight, for years, but Basil ended up becoming He was out exercising ley lines with this Anglican priest that he got. They were out exercising pagan ley lines, and I thought, gosh, doggone it! I don't think Dion Fortune would have particularly liked that.
I don't think they were effective. You know, a ley line is basically a natural force that's going to exist as long as the earth exists.
I know that, but and I remember Basil told Fred Adams one time. He said, Fred, you are creating a paradise for yourself, which you will certainly become bored with, you know, because Fred had all these beautiful natural young women running around in the orchard. And Basil told him, he said, "You're creating a paradise for yourself that you're eventually going to become bored with." So Lauren just told me that we've added an extra hour, and so we can ramble on for as long as we want. What would you, before we get into talking about the cosmic doctrine, which is kind of a heavy thing, let's talk about Moriarty and the whole structure of the Dr. Tavener story, because I know you've done the Broken Seal was a Dion Fortune type story.
I was very influenced by Secrets of Dr. Tavener. I read the book when I was 16 in one afternoon. Became just completely enchanted with it, and I think Dion Fortune and Dr. Tavener probably motivated me throughout my career in esotericism through the BOTA initiations and the founding of the Fraternity of the Hidden Light. And so I was in the Studio City house of Catherine Kurtz. She was living out here in California at the time, and she's the one that's written the marvelous Dorini science fiction, actually occult novels. And we found out that we were both just big Dr. Tavener fans, and we said, you know, what a pity she didn't write any more of these Dr. Tavener stories. And I said, well, you know, Catherine, you're an author. Why don't you write something? And we kind of brainstormed a little bit, and I said we could update it and bring it into the 20th later part of the 20th and into the 21st century. And so years later, she comes out with the Adept series, which are just enormously popular and very, very good. And I, as my tribute to Dr. Tavener, I came up with a book called The Broken Seal and Other Cases. And a sequel to that, a full-length novel, was The Dark Brotherhood, which I wrote with C.L. Forbes. And
by the way, let me mention that is a very exciting story, and it's available on Amazon. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thought that it's called The Dark Brotherhood, and it's a real thriller, and so I highly recommend that.
You know, the biggest compliment that you gave me and several other of the readers that reviewed the book was that there was a great extent, there was occult teaching in the vehicle of fiction, which is, I think, one of the hallmarks that we picked up from Dion Fortune. Because, as Dion Fortune said, when you were writing nonfiction, people always had a certain resistance to that because they felt that you were trying to preach to them in a more or less a manner. But in fiction, they could kind of relax, sit back, enjoy the ride. And while they're enjoying the ride, they became educated in the Hermetic teachings.
Yeah, right. Well, let's don't forget your co-author, Cindy, and that's The Dark Brotherhood by Paul Clark and Cindy Forbes. And Cindy is an adept in her own right, and that book is really, it's a real thriller, and you're right. It does. It also I hesitate to use that new term, infotainment. You know, infotainment. Yeah, it's sort of putting across the teachings in the form of but it's much more of a story than the Celestine Prophecy. You know, Celestine Prophecy does that in the form of fiction, but it's more teaching than fiction. In your case, the balance, you have a perfect balance of fiction and teaching.
I think Cindy's gets the credit for that. She took a basic story that I had written about a year or so ago and said, we can take this and we can make it entertaining and make it a first-rate novel for the modern reader so that they will enjoy it too, and that's what we tried to do. In fact, we have a sequel that should be coming out in about, I'd say probably 9 months from now to the Dark Brotherhood.
You got a title for it?
We've got a couple of working titles. I hesitate to talk about that right now, but
we'll be sure to let you know. Yeah, we'll be surprised, and you know that we'll be the first ones there to help you get that launched. Anyway, the to get back to Dion Fortune here a little bit, I'm going to make this. And I want you to correct me because I'm sure you know more about this than I do, but I think The Cosmic Doctrine is one of the most remarkable books of its type that I think that's ever been written. And the reason is that it's a channeled work. This is a channeled work, and it purports to be the teachings of an ascended master, someone who passed away, and she mentions in the foreword that this is a person that we would know who it was if she mentioned the name, but that the Cosmic Doctrine is just exactly that. It's an exposition of the formation of the universe in occult terms. And the formation of the earth and the development of man, spiritual man, the whole business. It's a monumental task, and it is remarkably free of any sort of there's no fluff in it. There's no fluff. There's no feeling that we're being told what we want to hear or anything like that. This really has the essence of something that's really coming from a much higher and remote and much more informed source. Now, if we channel over a whole series of sessions, I don't have many sessions to put this together, and I think now. I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, this owes something to the stanzas of Dijon. I think it does.
Yeah, you have an equivalency there, don't you? You can because the Secret Doctrine by Blavatsky was also broken into basically, well, the two volumes. The first volume was cosmology. The second volume was anthropology.
Yeah. The stanzas of the two ways of saying it, Dijon or Dijon, but I have it. You know, I have the and we in fact we even showed it on the cover on it. But I have the old teaching. But you know, for a long time, that book was suspect. For various reasons, it was suspect. But then, more recently, it's been revealed that book actually is a part of a very old Tibetan canon.
You know, it's typical, isn't it, that modern critique will say no automatically because it's something they're not used to, and then later on, they very quietly have to make their retraction and say, well, you know, there's something to this. I'm amazed at the Cosmic Doctrine. I don't think Dion Fortune knew this much. This is obviously testament to the reality of her interplane contacts, because it's such a profound teaching, so many profound principles that came through her. It's like I'll give you another example, a parallel example, Paul Foster Case and his interplane communications. Case. There's no way a man could have that much facility on balancing around the correspondences the way some of his communications. It obviously is a higher mentation that's flowing through him. Same thing with the Cosmic Doctrine and the Dion Fortune. In fact, Dion Fortune said, said this book was designed not to train the mind, but it was designed to train the mind, not inform it. And I think that anybody that's taken the time to read it will find that their mind is starting to be disciplined and trained through the images
yes,
that are presented.
And it's not, and unlike so many of these New Age, I don't mean to use the term New Age disparagingly, but let's just say so many of these New Age channeled works are more entertaining than they are informative.
Yeah, they always cast it back into some period where they can't be verified. Case called those Metafoozlers.
Yeah, but the cosmic doctrine is not entertaining.
No, it's
there's
it's
nothing entertaining
heavy.
About it. In fact, it's a very hard read. But you're right, and that's why she said you could read it 100 times. It's still not. It wasn't the purpose of it was not to inform you, but you're right, to train you. And it's a remarkable piece of work, and it's one of those things that you just know when you read it, you know that this is not something that's contrived to be impressive. It's just not. It comes from somewhere in a very, very deep and a very profound level. So that's one we want to certainly mention, and certainly encourage people when they're ready for it to give it a read. What would you say? What's your favorite Dion Fortune novel aside from Dr. Tavener of the novels? Which one do you like the best?
You know, I'm torn between two. I love all of her novels, but the two that I really, besides Dr. Tavener, which is clearly my favorite, would be The Demon Lover for just a good read, and then Moon Magic, which has so much esoteric knowledge packed into the pages that it's like attending a lecture and talking to her in person.
I'm glad you said that. I love Moon Magic. I just think Moon Magic is everybody interested. Of course, Wicca, you know, it was tremendously influenced. It influenced, Marion Zimmer Bradley was apparently more influenced by the Sea Priestess. But that was the Celtic, you know, when she did the Mists of Avalon. But still, Moon Magic, it was very influential on the Wiccans and Dorian Valiente, but by gosh, it sure influenced me. I just thought Moon Magic was. By the way, just a little bit. Dion Fortune used a character from Celtic mythology, Morgan Le Fay, and in this Moon Magic, she's fairly well off, and she can afford to get a lease on this old church. This old half-ruined church, and she turns this into a pagan temple, and she does her she performs her magical operations, her moon magic, in this wonderful setting. So it has a gothic. The novel has this gothic flavor of here she is in this old church, and she's the pagan priestess. And,
I've got something that will add to that for you. Did you know that the Abbey, which is what they call it, was an actual physical location that was operated by the Fraternity of the Hidden Fraternity of the Inner Light, and so it was actually based on her on a real location that Dion Fortune actually worked magic in.
Well, by gosh, I didn't realize that. That must have been before the society. The Society of the Inner Light still resonated as a Celtic ray, I guess maybe. she was a member of the McGregor Mathers Temple of the Alpha and Omega in London, and this of course is after the split. After the scandal and everything, so this was before World War I, I assume, and then she had a falling out with Moyna Mathers,
That's right.
Now,
it was based
on...
What
was the falling out all about?
Well, the falling out was that Moina had an aversion to sex. That's no other way to say it. And in fact, she and McGregor, or she and Samuel, were celibate their entire marriage relationship. So she was really, she had some hang-ups. Well, Dionne Fortune, one of her earlier books was The Doctrines of Love and Marriage, in which Moina called her on the carpet and said, "You've revealed secrets of higher degrees for the public. You should never have done that." And then somebody pointed out that she hadn't been initiated into those degrees yet, so there's no way that she could have gotten it from them. She must have gotten it from the Inner Planes. Well, that was, you know, probably a fatal thing for her to do, because now not only is Moina in disagreement with her, but she'd embarrassed Moina Mathers, which thing happened to Paul Case. And so she decided that she would transfer to another branch of the order. There were three basic branches after the split, the one headed by White, which was the Holy Order of the Golden Dawn at first, and then the Alpha and Omega, which was the one that Moina was the head of, and it was remained loyal to Mathers' memory, and then finally the Stella Macchettina, which you had mentioned before, which was held by, headed by Bob Falcon and W.B. Yeats.
Yeah.
And so she went over there to the Bristol, I believe it was the Bristol Temple, and that's where she met probably her second mentor, and I cannot remember the lady's name, but it was the lady who ended up as the in the moon magic as the senior priestess that helps her consecrate her temple in the abbey.
That tells the story there. I've always kind of suspected that that was just a suspicion I had, that Sam and Moina involved themselves in something we've called Coreza, which is sort of like it's generating power by close association, but no actual sex.
In other words,
kind of like bundling, you know. But you could generate a tremendous amount of power by doing this. It's somewhat of a frustration, but probably I kind of suspect that maybe they both drove themselves crazy doing this. It's just a suspicion I have.
She said that sex was the physical thought of sex was repugnant. So I don't know how much crazy they could have gotten away with,
but you're probably right. You're probably right. So this is my lecherous mind here imagining something that probably that I'm probably wrong. Yeah, and but somehow or other, the two of them, their sexual frustration got channeled into their psychic work. And so they used all that pit up power. Now, speaking of this, let's talk about the magical battle of Britain, and because Dionne Fortune, we all know, I'm sure all of us have heard, and I know Catherine Kirk's got into this and whatever, that the British witches supposedly got together in the New Forest and a couple of them died as a result of this thing. They were all out there in the rain and freezing their buns off, raising a cone of power to drive off the German invasion. And now it looks like Dionne Fortune was in some way involved in that. What do you know about that aspect?
Well, in Catherine Kurtz's novel Lammas Night, she has the hero, which is a British occultist, contact a Mrs. Penry Evans. Well, Mrs. Penry Evans, of course, was Dionne Fortune. And there evidently was, in fact, a gathering during the days of the Blitzkrieg, where the witches got together, and according to Dionne Fortune, several of them, which were the more elderly of the witches, voluntarily did not take the ointment that would insulate them from the cold, and acted as a self-sacrifice. And whether we agree with that or not, it was a symptom of their determination to drive back the Nazi threat. And they, the main thing they kept saying was, "You cannot come, you cannot come." And nobody, not counting that explanation, nobody has ever been able to offer a plausible alternate explanation of why Hitler did not go ahead and pursue the invasion, because he was already as far as the Jersey, island of Jersey, but he, for some reason he decided not. He kept holding off, and gave the British, gave us a toehold in the, where we could launch D-Day from Great Britain. If he had taken the Great Britain, we would have had no way that we could have launched an invasion of Europe, and he would have probably won World War II.
Yeah, you're right about that. I think we should mention, of course, that the other side of that is that Hitler kept hoping against hope that the British would side with him against the Bolsheviks, and it was a forlorn hope because they weren't about to do that, but he kept thinking they were, and Hess, of course, flying over there. Now, you know, Hess supposedly, according to some of these people that want to tar the Golden Dawn with a Nazi stick, they even claim that Hess was carrying letters to high adepts in the Golden Dawn when he flew. I think that's ridiculous, but I mean that Hess did. I don't think he did this entirely on his own. And they really didn't, you know, the Nazis really, really hoped that somehow or other the British would somehow or other they would change their minds and come along. It wasn't going to happen if they did. But, you know, I think that's one aspect, but then on the other hand, it's very possible that the witches did aid in driving off the invasion, because supposedly they did the same thing with the Spanish Armada. You remember that?
That's correct. And there's a thing in the novels about the drum of Sir Francis Drake being beat for the raise the cone of power back then. And there's a tradition in Great Britain that drum would be, you would hear it again when Britain was in need, and it would rouse the witches, or what they mean by witches is the initiates of the esoteric tradition, the occultists and the mystics, would be roused up to confront that threat. And in the novels, the drum is heard again. But, you know, something other than this one incident, I think the magical Battle of Britain points out something else that I think Dion Fortune made a great contribution. You know, they couldn't do organized group work anymore because of the Blitzkrieg and the fact that most of her initiates were serving in the Army or the Navy. And she started doing a coordination of newsletters that would go out on a monthly basis. And these newsletters would take, frankly, kind of green initiates who normally wouldn't have been exposed to this level of work, would take them, and they would be coordinating astral workings, and the effectiveness of these astral workings is something else that needs to be examined. And I think it's a great contribution that she made to the work, because for the first time, that level of work was published, and we've all benefited from it.
When was that published, and where is it available?
Gareth Knight once again published the book, The Magical Battle of Britain. And you can pick it up on Barnes & Noble probably, or Amazon.com for sure. And I believe it's published in Great Britain by Thulf Publication, which is our good friend Tom Clark. And he does a remarkable job over there of keeping her books in print. And it's a fascinating account. And I recommend that highly to anybody who's interested either in Dion Fortune or just the contribution of astral imagery, coordinated thought, power. It's just a remarkable book.
Yeah, well, I want to get a hold of that. I've heard all this about the magical Battle of Britain, but I didn't realize that they had published it, and that there were details on the rituals and all that. It's fascinating, and certainly, you know, that's one to really give a serious look to. So now, let's see here, the mystical Kabbalah. The book, The Mystical Kabbalah. Now, I said earlier, before you came on, that The Mystical Kabbalah was somewhat hampered by her decision to not to discuss the paths, and that was based upon her feeling that the path material which she had was all secret. And
in addition to that, Polk, she was contemplating a second volume. She just ran out of time, and that second volume would have dealt more with the past. But I heard your comments, and I agree with you. The past were much more obligated material than the Sephira.
Yeah. Well, now did this to go along with what you said earlier? Would that decision come after she had that set to with Moina about the love and marriage bit? Was that later? Because certainly that, you know, once she'd been beaten about the head and ears over the love and marriage book, and then maybe that was what influenced her to leave the paths out on the mystical Kabbalah, have I got my time frame wrong here?
The mystical Kabbalah was first published in 1935, so it was published towards the end of her life. I do know.
Yeah.
From talking to people who were that were students of hers and students of students, that it's well known that she actually cried through the night a couple of times because she really thought that she had revealed too much when she wrote The Mystical Kabbalah. She thought that she was getting ready for a backlash, which I don't know if it ever came, but that's how much she thought she revealed in The Mystical Kabbalah. You know, the initiatory system of the Golden Dawn, every one of their degrees was divided up into two sections. One section was the paths, and they were always represented in the king scale colors.
Yeah.
And those are the actual initiatory parts of the ceremonies. And then the initiate would finally arrive to the Sephira, which was represented in the queen scale. If you analyze those rituals, the first are initiatory. The second part, the part of the Sephira, is basically informative.
Yeah.
It's the lecture part. They use the Masonic parts.
Yeah.
And so I do know that Gareth Knight tried to remedy this in his Outline of Kabbalistic Symbolism, which is quite good. But
I love that book, the two volume set by Gareth Knight. That in fact, when we took when we developed our pathworking system based on Kirpal Singh's system, I used those two volumes by Gareth Knight as the, you know, when I said we got to Kabbalize this Kirpal system, and that's what I used, and that's that. But do you think that Gareth Knight, when he did the Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism, do you think he was trying to finish what Dion Vorchforschen started? Do you think that was
the... He's more or less said that.
He's more or less said that.
And basically, when you look at it, it is basically a commentary on the mystical Kabbalah, but the second volume is commentary on the past. Now, whether or not he referenced certain unpublished papers that were in the archives, I don't know. Oh, can I do a bit of shameless self-promotion
of course,
there?
For heaven's sake, we all do that. Go ahead.
For those that are interested in that, we are going to publish a book. It should be coming out in about 3 weeks. It can be procured on Amazon.com. It's called The Hermetic Kabbalah. And it is basically a development of this book, the same theme that Mystical Kabbalah and Gareth Knight's books are based upon. It's not the same book. We've got a lot of different information in there, but we thought, well, you know, I would like to present the way and the things that an initiate needs to know and what he would deal with going through these paths. So that book is going to be on Amazon.com. Should be in about, I'd say, probably three, 4 weeks.
Oh, that sounds great. And that's what we'll certainly want to get. Now let's see. Should we cover here with the unfortunate that we haven't already mentioned?
Well, one thing you were mentioning about the occult fiction of the unfortunate. Gareth and I published a book a couple of years back, and it's called The Occult Fiction of the Unfortunate. And it's just amazing to me that this lady, if you read her, become familiar with her life story. It was published in 2007, by the way. You read her life story, and then you read her fiction novels, which you and I particularly like, both of us. You find that they're based on the characters are based on real people and real locations. And in the case of Dr. Tavener, real cases that she said she wrote down instead of writing up, because she said most people wouldn't have believed them, even in fiction form, if she'd given it to us straight. So that's something that we need to consider, I think.
Yeah, well, and so that's the Gareth Knight's. Is Basil still alive?
Is who?
Or did he? Basil will be up. Gareth Knight, yes, he is.
I just procured a biography of his, and it's got some pictures. And he, like a lot of us, is getting a little thick around the waist. But he's still alive, and his daughter is also taking up the quest for the esoteric, and I was glad to see the book. I thought it was something that needed to be written.
Yeah, well, that sounds the magical fiction of Dion Fortune, right?
That's correct. It's published by...
Okay. By Interlight?
Both publications.
Wait a minute. What was that again?
It was published by Thoth Publications in 2007.
Okay, yeah.
Get it at Amazon.com also.
We'll definitely mark that one down, and we'll take a look at that. Now, I think we just about covered what we need to cover on this. And anything else you'd like to mention before we go ahead and sign off?
One critical thing that I was meditating on this last week. Dion Fortune entered, as we know, the Golden Dawn, and I forget why they there's always a question of motives when a candidate comes into the temple. Now, she chose to change that statement of why do you want to know? Why do you want to know? And she substituted, I desire to know that I may serve. And I think that that's one of the hallmarks of Dion Fortune's that almost all esoteric orders today have adopted. That service is the primary motive for initiation and transformation, that we desire to become better than we are, that we may, in fact, help others become better. And this service is, we really should say, tip the hat to Dion Fortune, because she's the first one to make that public.
Well, she certainly did serve us all and gave us a great treasure. And I know that she inspired you, and she inspired me, and she inspired many, many of our associates and students that we know, and teachers have been inspired by her work, and I'm very, very glad that we have been able to, thank you so much for all the inside information, because I wasn't aware of all the other publications that we need to look at in this regard. And this has really been fascinating, and I'm looking forward to the books that you mentioned, the Hermetic Kabbalah coming out, and the other ones, of course, that we mentioned, but especially the one that you're talking about, the Hermetic Kabbalah. And you're going to cover Dion Fortune to some degree in there, I imagine, too.
Yes, she's mentioned a couple of places.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I certainly appreciate being allowed to discuss this with you and share the information with you tonight.
Well, Paul, we're honored and pleased to have you, and come back anytime. And meanwhile, next week, by the way, we're going to be doing a rerun next week because I'm going to be deep in production on one of these magical productions that we're doing, and things get pretty intense. And so next week we'll cover it with a rerun, and the week after that we're going to have a show. And this is going from the light to the dark, but we're going to do it in a lighthearted sort of way, and we're going to discuss the history and the origin and what's behind the modern satanic movement, and how it got started and how it what it was behind, and we're not going to be recruiting for it, but we are going to sort of set the record straight on a few things, because I think that everybody needs to know just where this thing is at. So 2 weeks from now, we're going to be back with Satanism then, now, and later this evening. So look forward to that one. And meanwhile, thanks again, Paul, and good magic.